Give the now to Ana Paola Pires. Ana Paola Pires, she's a postdoctor fellow at the Università Nova di Lisboa. She is the reference point, I can say, about a great war for Portugal. She's involved in a lot of projects, international projects on the war, and she's actually studying the relation between Europe and Africa in during the First World War. And so I give her the please.
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to ask to thank Maximiliano for inviting me to be here, and of course, thanking Patricia for such a generous words. When Maximiliano invited me, this was kind of a challenge, because usually the intellectuals and their involvement in the war are not a topic that I approach directly. But I said yes, and I like challenges, and this one was another one, so I decided to study what was the role of the Portuguese intellectuals during the First World War. And for this presentation, I prepared it having in mind four specific topics. Well, the first one was trying to do some state of the art and try to analyze which was the role that intellectuals and their participation in the Great War had on the Portuguese historiography. The other question to understand the other two that I'm going to present has to do with the Portuguese position during the conflict, which is a position that, because we are neutrals, but not as neutrals as I'm going to explain it later, and then belligerent from 1916 onwards. The third point I would like to approach has to do with intellectuals' position in 1914, in the beginning of the conflict in Europe. And the fourth, has to do with a division that is very clear in the Portuguese way that the intellectuals behave, has to do with the behavior of the intellectuals both in the front line and those who are in the home front, and the way that they saw the war and how they approach it within their works. So within the outbreak of the First World War, it appeared in Portugal a new generation of writers and intellectuals, an aesthetic and politically heterogeneous generation united in the way the conflict marked their works and their thoughts. The First World War was, therefore, not only a great military and political event, it was also a great imaginative moment, changing the way in which man and woman thought not only the war and what it meant for a country to be at war, but also the world culture in its multiple expressions. A considerable part of this generation of intellectuals were young Republicans, who joined an effort since 1911 in a group named Renascença Portuguesa, in English, Portuguese Renaissance, or whatever. I must say that, of course, most of you are aware, but there was in 1910, there was a transition, a Republican government in Portugal, and the monarchy was overthrown in a revolution on the October 5th, 1910. So this generation is very much engaged with that overthrown of the monarchy. This new generation gathered intellectuals such as Teixeira de Pascoais, Jaime Cortesão, Leonardo Coimbra, António Sérgio, Raul Proença, or men who were presented themselves and saw the war as an opportunity that drove the Renaissance, this movement, since this formation. It had to do with the promotion of Portugal's cultural elevation, civic, ethical, and moral, and spiritual, and those in whose ultimate goal was the creation of a kind of a new man. This idea of new man is going to be rearranged by the fascism and the Estado Novo. So, but here there's also the perspective and the idea that when the war ended, there'll be a new man, a new Portuguese man, more enlightened than those who went to the war, which would provide the Republic with a vital and spiritual strength, ending, therefore, the secular decline of Portugal. During the war years, few literary works were published in Portugal, First of all, due to material restrictions created by the conflict. One of the few exceptions was a book titled Umush by Raoul Brandon, edited in 1917. A novel or anti-novel or even an ontological anxiety diary of a man of all time. And through the characters that the writer projects, it is a metaphysical questioning. However, the number of books produced in Portugal during the First World War, it was notably, exceptionally with regard to the non-fiction publications. But like Patricia mentioned in her presentation, they were published a lot of years before the war. Memoirs, essays, studies, chronics, articles, and diaries. And here the militaries are dominant. They produce a lot of memoirs during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. So the Portuguese historiography has devoted few pages to the role played by the Portuguese intellectuals during the war. There is no specific publication on this matter. Its content is dispersed quite synthetically in various monographs. One of the topics that is most addressed in the influence that the war had on literature, in particular the emergency of modernism. But this influence is not always analyzed in a direct way. In fact, as Patrizia Doliani has already shown for the Italian case, the First World War throughout the 80s and 90s of the 20th century was predominantly studied within a military perspective, reality that is also true in Portugal. Topics related with home front or everyday life in the trenches began to be analyzed in the late 90s and the early 2000s. It is therefore difficult to analyze the place of the First World War in the Portuguese culture. On the other hand, as we shall see throughout this presentation, the position of the Portuguese intellectuals on the participation in European theater of war was never consensual. Impersonating well how the Portuguese society was divided, we should also stress that within the intellectuals, it never existed a truly pacifist movement as in other European countries. So let's analyze now in detail which one was this position of Portugal facing the war. Well, the Portuguese Republic was fighting for its internal consolidation since its foundation in October 1910. The first election law of the new regime was published on March 14, 1911. Although it advised a substantial extension of the right to vote, the law fell below the promises made by the Republicans. In the summer of 1914, there were several sectors of the population to whom the right to participate politically was still denied. This situation caused, of course, growing discontent and generalized unease. The arguments presented to explain the Portuguese intervention in the European war front are mainly three. These are consensual arguments by the Portuguese historiography. First of all, the colonial thesis that highlighted the importance of the Portuguese colonies in Africa and analyzed the way in which these territories were faced as a bargaining chip in the European geostrategic situation since the end of the 19th century. I should remember that in 1898, a dramatic year for Spain as well, Great Britain, despite the alliance with Portugal, had secretly discussed with Germany the sharing of the Portuguese colonies in Africa. And this secret agreement was discussed already in 1912, 1913. The other argument that has justified the Portuguese intervention in the war has to do with the European or peninsular thesis that relies on the argument that the Republica entered the war to regain the place that Portugal had lost in the concert of European nations, moving away the always present threat of Spanish annexation and therefore ensuring the reinforcement of an alliance with Britain. The third thesis has to do with the internal defense of the regime, supporting that the Portuguese intervention in the war had to be seen as part of a plan conceived by the Democratic Party of Afonso Costa, the leader of the Democratic Party, to whom the Portuguese intervention in the European conflict would strengthen the regime not only internally, but it would reinforce also the political weight of the Democrats in a scenario where the fragmentation of the Portuguese political spectrum was increasingly visible. So by presenting itself as a war of alliances, the Great War showed the impossibility of European nations to fight alone, which from the Portuguese perspective meant that in case of victory, the regime would see the consolidation recognized abroad and by all victors. The last thesis, this in the thesis of the internal defense of the Republic, so has in a very clear division, we can single out two specific periods as regards the Portuguese position in the First World War. A first period from July 1914 to March 1916 that witnessed the domestic debate on the position, should the country be neutral, should the country fight a war, and here when we say get involved in the war and fight, the German question is never posed. Portugal will enter the war with her ally, with Great Britain. So the Germanophily argument doesn't exist. It's very residual in a very low percentage of the population and quite few intellectuals. The other period is the period of the active belligerency from March 1916 to November 1918. And here are the years of the Portuguese participation in the Great War in Europe on the Entente side, with the imposing of conscription measures and the preparation and shipping of a Portuguese military corps. So it is necessary to keep in mind the contradictory circumstances that surrounded the Portuguese position. Namely the fact that under the advice of the British Foreign Office, of course, Portugal could not declare itself either belligerent or neutral against the war in Europe. This position was expressed from the start in the friendship statement made by the Prime Minister to all nations, but in which the intention of the Portuguese government not to fulfill in any circumstances the duties of the alliance with England were clearly present. So behind this declaration of neither neutral or belligerency was a strategic comprehension of the importance of the use of the seaports of both the Atlantic coast and Africa by the Royal Navy, and the necessity that, together with the need to reduce traffic and the commercial relations between Germany and Portugal, to be granted to the British government the right of passage of troops through the Portuguese colonial territories. So to Britain, the statement delivered in the Parliament by the Portuguese government on August 7, 1914, allowed Portugal to play the role of collaborationist ally, capable to provide artillery or to guarantee the right of passage of troops, without, however, to become a direct confrontation with the Central Powers. Let us mention that this position also pleased Germany. And here I should say that Portugal sent troops to Africa, to Angola and Mozambique, right from the start of the war in 1914 and without a war declaration from Germany or from the Central Powers. So this is a very peculiar case because Portugal was involved in the war since the beginning. The country's involvement in the European front of the war only happened from 1916 onwards, but from 1914 until 1916 there was also a campaign in Africa. On the armed force side, the majority of the officers was against the war, especially of sending troops to the European theater. They claimed that the troops were not ready for such a fight because the military reform that was imposed in 1911 didn't have the effects or the results that should be expected. So the war ended up exposing daily the cruelty, the limitations of republicanism, eventually created the context and generated the conditions not only for the appearance but also for the justification of the first experiments manifestly anti-parliamentary and anti-liberal. And here I must explain the governments of Pimenta de Castro and Sidónio Paes, who were in fact dictatorships. The assertion of the primacy of discipline and order and the economic orientation following a conservative matrix, particularly as regards the definition of the role of the state, distancing itself from the trends that were drawn by the democratics in the beginning of the war, eventually formed an important and characteristic pause in the history of the Portuguese home front during the war years, creating ruptures and provoking lasting and profound impacts. As a whole, the Portuguese participation in the First World War marked the end of the Portuguese First Republic. The war exposed and exacerbated all cleavages that had characterized the regime since October 1910, emphasized the unpopularity of the Democratic Party and of Afonso Costa, and helped to intensify in the interwar years the conflict between the labor movement and the regime. Now, As to the position of the Portuguese intellectuals in 1914 and during the beginning of the war, well, Mário de Sá Carneiro, a very known Portuguese poet, wrote to Fernando Pessoa on August the 1st, 1914, giving him an account of the distress at the outset of the First World War, which led from the day onwards on the day of the first major mobilization of France. And I quote what he wrote, Fernando Pessoa. "I am writing you in a horrible time, my dear friend, to the world, to Europe, and even personally to me, to us. What will happen? No one knows. But in the present, the war seems inevitable. All European arms, I am very sad. Moreover, although the dangers, I would like to leave this war in Europe, in Paris." There was no pacifist movement among the Portuguese intellectuals, as I mentioned, apart from some monarchist voices aligned in the Integralismo Lusitano with especially António Sardina. Among the Republicans, the only voice who was out of tone was one of António Sérgio, who thought that the Portuguese involvement with the war had to be a previously homework. You know, they have to reform the regime, reform the culture, and reform the mentality, and especially reform the economic and financial circumstances in which the country was back then. So for them, the involvement in the war would be chaotic. So since the first intellectual positions on the war, a neo-romantic historicism fed the war perspectives. Jaime Cortesão, that in 1914 wrote for the newspaper O Norte, a newspaper from O Porto, he wrote a set of articles on the theater of war, and wanting to assume in a magazine he named A Vida Portuguesa, a collective position of the group Renascença Portuguesa in the name of the Latin fraternity. If to our population smallness, we add the economic imbalance and disruption of national forces, he says, they did not demonstrate a great usable power in the conflict, according to Cortesão. It was necessary to disclose the little, and I quote, the little or much that avail ourselves as creators in the arts, sciences, and philosophy in favor of that Latin spirit. So Portugal was involved with, had an alliance with Britain, but as Maria Inês and Patricia mentioned in the opening session, this idea of a Latin community is very present as well in the Portuguese intellectuals. In the editorial of December of the journal A Vida Portuguesa, starts decisively, and Cortesão says, and I quote, "The Renascença Portuguesa, in the fulfillment of its program, cannot distance herself from the historical moment that crosses the homeland. The time is not for words, but for concrete facts." Appealing to his patriotic duty, he launches the idea of creating an organization society for military instruction, whose bases are disclosed by the board of directors, from which Jaime Cortesão is one of the signatories. Even without action, this initiative is deeply significant. Between 1915 and 1935, they expressed themselves in Portuguese life. Writers and artists such as Mário de Sá Carneiro, Fernando Pessoa, José de Almada Negreiros, or António Ferro, who is going to be the Minister of Propaganda for Salazar. They intervene in changing society and left a strong argumentative tension against the ascetic conservatism that dominated the demo-republican liberalism in Portugal during the First Republic. António Ferro, the same minister of Salazar a few years later, was the editor of two issues of the journal Orfeu in 1915 and one of the founders of the journal Exile in 1916. In the poem Passo de Marcha, published in January 4, 1915, in the magazine Ilustração Portuguesa, he expressed a political speech interventionist, sharing a political attitude that was in line with the positions of the Portuguese Republican Party. And he says, "Portuguese go to war, firm chest, look loyal. Let their lives there bring life to Portugal. Blood of heroes stains the grass. Where there is olive tree branches, blood and grass, Portuguese." And this is a poem in 1915. Modernists, among who were the names of Fernando Pessoa, Mário de Sá Carneiro, and Almada Negreiros, made themselves noticed to the public in March 1915 during the dictatorship of General Pimenta de Castro. when they published the first issue of a Portuguese journal, a magazine, sorry, named Orfeu. Fernando Pessoa wrote himself several essays of historical reflection on the First World War, which were never published during his life. But let us briefly mention his Martial Ode, a poem of whom it exists only three fragments, signed by his heteronym Albert Campos. It is first text that date back from the beginning of the war in the summer of 1914. In general, the tone of the poem is melancholic and not exalted, as in others by Albert Campos. He says, "War, civilizations march in front of me. In a triumphant morning, in a long line like that painted on my soul, successively, indeterminately, breastplates, spears, helmets shining, shields facing me, visors fallen, coats of knit." Embedded itself in intense modernism was the chronic that Mário de Sá Carneiro sent from Paris on the Battle of Marne in December 1915, that testified the anniversary of the tragedy. After a vocal, and I quote, "the sublime anonymity of the 3,000 who merely obeying resisted," indeed, in Marville, a whole imperial division with the same emotion that we evoked, a poor old abandoned plan that at night appeared in battlefield. In the end, the poet celebrates rather the life that remains and insists on the days that follow the battle. It is about the tragedy of life that whispers how beautiful. Early in 1914, when he began a public campaign for the Portuguese military intervention in the war, Jaime Cortesão was showing a vision based on the civilized choice of a free and democratic England and a big, beautiful, and generous France against Germany and the Catholic and despotic Austria that symbolized the vision of two philosophers, in one side, Jean-Marie Guyot, and on the other side, Friedrich Nietzsche. Another intellectual, Augusto Casimiro, would mention a fight between two hostile principles, generous freedom and tyrannical force. According to Cortesão, the participation in the war would have the capacity and ability to unite and regenerate the Portuguese. He was quite wrong. He did exactly the opposite. The country was never united within the participation in the European theater of war. It would be a kind of redemption through suffering and rebirth. It is present a vitalist conception and an apology of action and heroism. By action, we can perhaps relate to the influences exerted by Nietzsche in this generation. Once again, the intellectuals of Renascença Portuguesa, a political movement that appeared in Porto soon after the proclamation of the Republic, as I mentioned, will support the Portuguese entrance in the war in March 1916. Long and difficult still will be the preparation of the collective conscience to decide the military cooperation with the Allies. In a special issue of a magazine of the Renaissance Portuguesa, the name was A Águia, is published a special issue on the topic of Portugal and the war, in which, to the usual collaborators of the magazine, others are gathered, namely notable artists and writers of that time. In this sense, imbued with a sense of educational mission, the members of Renascença Portuguesa engage themselves in the defense of the interventionist cause, and yet their reasons have an ethical, moral, and spiritual background that differentiate them from the pragmatic goals of political power then. They place themselves besides a large part of the Republic political elite, including the democratic Afonso Costa and the evolutionists led by António José de Almeida. On the first article, Teixeira de Pascoais explained that, and I quote, "the attitude of Águia as an organ of the Renascença Portuguesa has to be exclusively favorable to our participation in the war. If those who provoke an unfair or unnecessary war are the biggest criminals in the world, it is not a crime to defend a war that it's going to defend our homeland and free our people," end of quote. And he interpreted the Portuguese involvement in the war in face of a nostalgic doctrine. And I quote, "it was our past who launched the war. In order to secure our future, the past looks for the future," end of quote. In this context, Renascença Portuguesa undertook from 1917 onwards until the early 20s, the edition of a series of works on the war, mostly memoirs and diaries of ex-soldiers, many of them writers, such as Augusto Casimiro, who was fighting in Africa, and Jaime Pina de Moraes. For the integralists of António Sardinha, The war had become the last, albeit dangerous, wisdom against the tendencies of decay, was at last a last resort of hope. From them, there were no doubts. It was time to follow the instructions of the ex-king Manuel II and unite themselves facing the country at war. They receive instructions to go to the front and take part in the Portuguese expeditionary force. In diaries and in memoirs, it is often found an apologetic action version of the combat soldier, the peasant in uniform, but it arises also the value of the militia war officers who took risks at the front. The narrative of Courtesan is very paradigmatic concerning this particular aspect. It is covered by the redemptionist vision of the action of the soldier, who should converge politically with the action of an enlightened vanguard elite. Collectively, the war, and I quote Courtesan, collectively the war in our war, the soldier was saved. He was always patient and suffering and heroic. Among the officers, as a rule, the more graduated they were, the worse, because war educates the old virtues of small fry and that the soldier were asleep. With the Portuguese entrance in the war, nationalism as a modern ideology itself was born, while nationalism contents of a fictionalized discourse on the Portuguese based on conservative values, the nation, virility, religion, the glory of the past, and a certain idea of people or Portuguese men, developed by such authors as Afonso Lopes Vieira or António Correia de Oliveira. So the creation of the war in the post-war will be made by authors such as António Ferro or João Amiel during the Estado Novo. So this particular period of time, especially Portugal is involved in a battle which is named the Battle of Lalis, and a significant part of the Portuguese force dies there. And this is almost a stain in the Portuguese history. So during the Estado Novo, the official history tends to blame the Republicans for the involvement in the war and for the disaster that Lalis was. So this is very instrumentalized during the fascist period. The experience of war and war with capital G in particular appeared in the eyes of many intellectuals as an opportunity to fight decay and create a new kind of Portuguese and consequently a new Portugal. In 1918, writers realized that the First World War had been the beginning of a more violent age. And Augusto de Castro wonders, where are we going? For a better world? At the end of the war. And in that stage, do we find ourselves today? Advance? Are we shrinking? In the words of Agustín de Campos, and I quote, the war gave to contemporary society a centrifugal force of antisocial instincts, overturned in a few years the methodical and artificial work of many centuries of education, returned man to his animal nature and therefore inhuman. Anarchy won over hierarchy, materialism to spiritualism, and ferocity of gentleness, laziness to diligence, superstition, religions, gambling, addition to the dignity and the effort. The crass cynism, moral mediocrity, and semi-hypocritical honesty of gathering those who call themselves civilized. So in short, and to finalize my presentation, the full impact of the First World War in the Portuguese society needs, of course, yet to be fully accessed based on a more direct approach and especially analyzing what these intellectuals think and not only as what is happening in the last years in Portugal, not only analyzing the impact that the war had on literature, but what impact it also had on the man who wrote and who produced those books. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the very interesting contribution, just enriching the entire discussion of these days. Preguntas, domande, questioni. In this silence, I try to ask something. Well, one is the question of Latin fraternity. which is questioning the identity of Portuguese. No? Do they really consider Latin or Neo-Latin in this, or is a sort of revival in this renaissance of being part of a community or Latin community? The second question is about Catholic intellectuals. I have difficulties to find some in Italy, some Catholic intellectual speaking, speaking out or loudly about pacifism or interventionism, because of the position of the Catholic Church since the beginning of the war. Do you find some intellectuals, conservative intellectuals, having part in the discussion, or there was the same silence? I could find or check in the Italian community of a Catholic community of intellectuals. And then it's interesting that you. Speaking about the adjectivation of neutrality, the Portuguese case is a very interesting, another interesting case of not being neutral, remaining neutral for a few years, but be part of a large economic intervention, of taking part in the economic war. And reminds me the case of another country at the other side of Europe, like Greece, and the importance of seaports, in terms of being in one front or the other. The case of Salonico and in Greece, and Salonico works for the Allies, for the British troops. I think it's practically the same in the relations between Africa and you. Yes. You stress this case for Lisbon and Porto.
It will be a good comparative study between Portugal and Greece during this year.
Oh, this is interesting.
It would be because there are similarities you mentioned. The Portuguese ports are very. Very important for Britain during these years in Africa, and there is a question that I didn't mention in this presentation, but when the war started in 1914, I don't remember his name. He was governor or consul of British consul in Lawrence Marks. He had a map, and he pointed out in that map, and he writes that to the Foreign Office, saying which ports have more commercial relationships with Germany, and which ports had more commercial relationships with Britain. And he has this sentence that is very clear, because their strategy was similar to what was done with Latin America, to try to recover all those ports. And he's very clear, and he says, well, war cannot create commerce, but he might correct it. So the idea was to try to bring Britain more involved in those ports. And in Lisbon is quite similar, because there are a few areas where Germany already was almost matching Britain in concerning importation of products. So the war was presenting itself with that opportunity too. The question that you mentioned on Catholic intellectuals, it's the same. I could not find any positions on pacifism. But the war introduces an interesting question in the Portuguese case. Well, when there was the Republican Revolution, there was a law published in 1911 that was separating state from church. And we ended our relationships with the Vatican. And when the war started, the law was there. Then it's going to be revised by the dictatorship of Sidónio Paes. But during the war, in order to content the soldiers who were mostly Catholics, there were they will allow priests and ministers from all religions to go and you know, they were involved in that aspect of the war as well. The other question with the Latin, of course, Portuguese consider themselves Latins, and although it might sound a little bit weird because we have an ancient alliance with Britain, but the intellectuals of this period of time, as in other countries in Europe, spoke mainly French, and the references were French, and the idea of a Latin past with Rome as the creator of that past, and with the images and the marks that the Romans left in the country, is very much revised, and it's very very we evoke the involvement in the war with our ancient ally Britain, but the community that we belong, it's the Latin community, and it's that community that we are going to save from the barbarism of Germany during this year. So I think it's very clear that when it comes to rescue the civilization, it's the Latin civilization that needs to be rescued, and not There is clearly a difference between which is the diplomatic questions and the economic questions that we have with Britain, and the cultural matrix that is very present, and that's Latin.
No, it's very interesting. The sentence you quoted, the one of these intellectuals wished to be in Paris, during the war. We don't want to have a round table here, so I ask if there are questions, especially to the other colleague about the Argentinian case.
I have both questions, one for Marines and another one for you. I start with the English one. To continue with the Portuguese case, I was wondering about how Spanish discourses are perceived in among Portuguese intellectuals. For example, I was thinking about the two kind of discourses on Portugal and more specifically on the idea of Iberia, a confederation of Portugal and Spanish, on the one hand, I mean with among intellectuals or politicians who support the Allies, but on the other hand, there are other discourses that stand during the first years of the war in Spain. Understand that some kind of a reconquest of Portugal. I don't know if what I mean, but I think that these two ideas, this division that we can see here in Spain. I don't know how these two discourses are perceived. Or I don't know if you have any idea. And the other one era un poco sobre la idea del hispanismo. Es decir, cómo estaba pensando en cómo el hispanismo, la idea del panhispanismo, pensaba por ejemplo en Altamira, Rafael Altamira, que llegó a Buenos Aires antes. Pero cómo, si la idea del hispanismo solo está entre los germanófilos, en Argentina me refiero, del neohispanismo, evidentemente, o es más transversal. Porque es un tema que me preocupa y parece que es bastante interesante y no sé si es un tópico repetir esto de que los germanófilos son los que, digamos, plantean una idea un poco de vuelta o un hispanismo antiguo, un neohispanismo en todo caso, o si en realidad es una cosa un poco más transversal.
Thank you for the question. Yes, there is. The idea of a union between Portugal and Spain is very marked during the war years. There are a couple of intellectuals, namely one of them which is more active. His name is Ezequiel de Campos. He's an engineer that writes abundantly, and he lives, you know, for ages, because he's going to be also active during the Estado Novo as one of the most active engineers of the country. He's very well known. And during the war years, he's involved in a group which is called Pilagrei. And it's a magazine that it's going to be published in 1918, and he gathers intellectuals from the Republican Party, namely António Sérgio, Ezequiel de Campos. They are the most active. And that magazine, between 1918 until almost the end of the beginning of the year, until the end of the year, publishes massively. And a significant number of the articles that are published are evoking the union of Portugal and Spain as the salvation of the country, who is going to be very, very poor after the war. So we should unite ourselves with our brothers, and they do what they go back to the monarchy and to our first king Afonso Henriques, and saying that the Portugal and Spain should not be two separate countries. They are only one. That it doesn't make any sense to have that division. The other idea, and the idea of the invasion, it's a very present idea in the Portuguese history. I was saying yesterday at dinner that we have a Portuguese saying that says, and I'm going to say it very very slowly in Portuguese: de Espanha nem bom vento nem bom casamento. So this is very clear of the difficulties that they were between the two countries. And when in 1914, when there is the declaration of war from Britain to Germany, one of the questions that immediately raises, as Portugal has, well, of course, Spain was not that much committed with one of the sides. You know, there are Germans, but they are British. But with Portugal, it was very clear: we should go to the war with Britain, not with Germany. And when the question was raised, which one should be the position of Spain, the Republicans and the Democrats for Afonso Costa instantly said that Portugal should take part in the war, especially to distance himself from Spain. You know, they are neutrals, but we are brave and we are going to fight. And otherwise, they realized that if Portugal remained neutral and if Spain aligned themselves with Germany, the danger of the invasion and the loss of the colonies would be even better. So we look at our neighbor during those years with very, very, very suspicious manner. So that question is going to be raised again during the Second World War, and I think now there are a couple of researchers that discovered apparently there were in fact some invasion plans in Spanish archives. So the idea is very, very present in the history. Now it's I think we have no fear. I think that Spain is not planning to invade us, at least shortly, so we are a bit quieter.
Until the crisis is over.
Yes. Bueno, gracias por la pregunta, Maxi. Con respecto a esta cuestión del hispanismo, comenzó en el caso de Argentina a ser recuperado desde la crisis de 1898, ¿no? Ahí empieza a haber algunos intelectuales, sobre todo también ligados al catolicismo, que empiezan a buscar las raíces hispánicas. Y esto vuelve a tener una manifestación más clara en 1910, durante el centenario de la Revolución de Mayo, cuando se producen los llamados debates sobre la argentinidad, en los que intervienen los principales intelectuales, interviene Lugones planteando al gaucho como producto autóctono y supuestamente originario de la Argentina, con el que debería identificarse esa raza argentina. Iba a surgir en ese sentido Manuel Gálvez con la recuperación de España como la madre de esa raza argentina, ¿no? Es decir, ya Gálvez venía teniendo diversos trabajos, como el diario de Gabriel Quiroga, va a tener El Solar de la Raza, en los cuales va a intentar recuperar la idea de España, ¿no? Y la afiliación de Argentina con España. De todas formas, son intelectuales minoritarios, ¿no? Frente a esa tendencia francófila que es la que predomina. Y durante la guerra, desde el comienzo, son los germanófilos los que estimulan esa reaproximación con España por, bueno, por las razones que comentaba la otra vez, ¿no? La idea de, ya que no podemos lograr volcar a la opinión en favor de Alemania, por lo menos tratemos de neutralizar el avance sajón en el continente y tomar la idea de España como espejo de neutrales, tomando un poco la imagen de Espinós Moltó, ¿no? Pero después, en 1917, en esa coyuntura en la que se pone en juego o en cuestionamiento la idea de neutralidad, ya va a ser un tanto más extenso este hispanismo o la apelación a este hispanismo, y de hecho se va a hacer desde el propio Estado, cuando Irigoyen vaya a promover esa reivindicación de España con ese decreto por el que establece el Día de la Raza y en el cual explícitamente la reivindica por el descubrimiento, la conquista y la colonización de América, ¿no? Entonces la coloca en un lugar que hasta ese momento había sido marginal, ¿no? En general había primado la hispanofobia. Pero me parece que, quiero decir, entonces a partir de 1917 se puede hablar, si se quiere, incluso de una política oficial pro-hispanista y pro-hispanoamericanista, las dos cosas, ¿no? Esas dos vertientes del hispanismo. Aunque al comienzo de la guerra es más acotado el mundo de sectores intelectuales que sostiene esa postura, ¿no?
Gracias, thank you. Passiamo direttamente al finale, alle conclusioni con il professore José Álvarez Junco, presentato da Angel, no? Chi? Dos? Los dos? Da Angel Duarte.